Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's Sunday, October 29th, right. 2017.
Right.
And it's a rainy, rainy day.
Right. Rainy day, a couple days from Halloween.
Right, but we already talked about Halloween, right. So we don't have to really talk about Halloween anymore.
No.
And we've been out and about.
Right. Last night, big event, we were at 54 Below in Manhattan.
Feinstein's
54 Below. Exactly, which is the space beneath Studio 54.
And it's a cabaret.
Exactly right. It's a cabaret performance, which you get to see sometimes. A very interesting performers in a very small space. It's intimate.
Right.
And last night we saw Laura and Linda Benanti.
Benanti,
right. And Laura Benanti is, as many of you know, one of the biggest stars on Broadway. And she's done several television shows besides. I was even reminded in looking at her bio that she was in Supergirl on television.
Yes, I've seen her in Supergirl.
Have you
ever watched Supergirl?
It looks like that would be kind of an icky part, but you tell me. How is she in Supergirl?
Yeah, she was good. I didn't realize who it was at the time.
Right.
You know, she was good.
Yeah, but in any event, she rules on the Broadway stage. She's been in several big musicals. Most recently, She Loved Me. She's a great singer. She's had a very acclaimed cabaret act for the last year or two. But what's particularly fascinating about this is she was performing with her mother.
Right.
Linda Benanti. And Linda Benanti, her story is that in New Jersey, she settled down. She had a child, Laura. And while she had a promising career as a singer, having a child, Linda Benanti settled down to teach voice, including teach her daughter. And the result is you have Laura Benanti, a big star, and Linda Benanti, who didn't really perform for a period of 35 years.
Her daughter enticed her back
as recently as just a few months ago and said, you know, Mom, you still can sing. I love the way you sing. Other people will love the way you sing. Let's get on stage together.
And well, we don't know exactly what she said.
I think I know.
Laura Benanti recently had a child. February, she had a baby.
That's right.
And she had already developed a cabaret act before that.
So she's incorporated her mother in it and enticed her to come on the stage with her. And the result is great.
Yeah, you almost wish she would do more of that.
What do you mean?
More cabaret acts. She's just on a couple nights, and then she's going to be on. Well, they're going to be back again in February.
Oh, you wish.
But this is great. It's like you're 12 feet from the performer.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if we read this article about extolling the virtues of cabaret.
Right.
That pointed out that nobody. Under the age of, say, 60, goes to this stuff, or even has heard of cabaret.
Very few people go to it generally. Cabaret is a very small audience. That's by definition.
It's sort of very expensive, except that...
Well, I'm not saying it's expensive. I'm just saying it's got a small audience.
But it is expensive.
It's comparable to a Broadway ticket. If anything, it's less.
Yes. But it's just kind of amazing.
Right.
As that one article pointed out that we both read, what if you had, like, Adele... singing in a little situation where it's just
a little bit of a shouter,
people.
But you could see some. It's like being in a room with Frank Sinatra, and he's like at the next table, and we're talking about being within 10 feet of these people.
Very intimate.
Very intimate. You relate differently. You hear it differently. You're overwhelmed by it in the way you're not overwhelmed otherwise. And what added to this was the dynamic between the mother and the daughter.
Yeah.
And there were moments in it. I mean, Laura Benanti carried most of the weight, but Linda sang extremely well. And a woman that you were telling me you think must be 70 years old.
Well, I don't know. We could Google it, but we didn't.
Laura's 38. Laura's 38. So
right.
she is, if she's not 70, she's close to it.
Yeah.
And there was one set in particular where she sang The Man Who Got Away, the Judy Garland standard, which is a heartrending, pounding a number, and she pulled it off, and you could see Laura just sitting in the shadows a few feet away in tears, listening to her mother sing. And you say to yourself, is that real? And I thought it was real.
Yeah. And so we're, as spectators, kind of participating in that.
Sure.
Not just hearing the song,
but
just this kind of interconnection with these performers.
Yes, that was absolutely.
So
it was a great evening.
Yeah.
Great evening.
Studio 54.
Right.
Or 54 Below. And,
keep your eyes open. You got to buy the tickets quickly. We lucked out. We got on the waiting list and got in.
But they have name people. But they also have people that are not necessarily household names.
Right. They have Christine Ebersole on Monday, but they have many lesser lights following
that. Who are worth hearing. Yeah. And we're looking forward to trying to
see. It's easy for us to say. We saw Laura Benante. But, it probably is worth hearing. Art World. Big art report today. We lead with that.
New biography of Alexander Calder, the 20th century sculptor.
Right.
Known for his mobiles. And in fact, he sort of originates the concept of these moving sculptures. And so this biography is by Jed Pearl, and it's called The Conquest of Time. And so I love thinking about Calder because there's also Alexander Calder, his father, a sculptor, and Alexander Calder, his grandfather, a sculptor. His grandfather, Alexander Milne Calder, emigrated from Scotland. He was a tombstone carver who also is responsible for sculpting a great many of the statues on the top of Philadelphia City Hall.
Really?
Yeah. But I think of him because he did funeral tombstones and other kind of funerary sculptures at my favorite Philadelphia cemetery, Laurel Hill Cemetery. And his son, Alexander Sterling, also did sculptures there. And so, Halloween time of year, it's kind of fun to think about Laurel Hill, which has spectacular sculptures and monuments. And it's a fun place to roam around and dates back to 1830. And its heyday was in the late 19th century and just fun stuff. But anyway, so I know you're on the edge of your seat about this biography, Nespa.
Well, no, you told me that it's that Calder number one was interesting because he went to Stevens Institute and started as an engineer, right?
Well, wouldn't that be Calder number three?
Calder number three.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, his parents leave it up to him what he wants to do with his life.
Right.
And he goes to engineering school.
Right.
And I think his father is working in the New York area at the time, so he goes to Stevens Institute. And so he starts out in engineering, but he ends up in the family business in sculpture. So this review is actually written by a professor of engineering at Duke.
Right.
And he actually is disappointed that there are only two chapters in the book about Calder's engineering.
That's right, because that's why he's famous.
So that's pretty funny. But anyway, sounds like a good book. There was just a great exhibition of his mobiles at the Whitney that has closed, sad to say. It sounds interesting. So if you're interested in engineering and art, that's the way to go.
The next article is one that was found by me, the next art article. That doesn't happen often. And it has to do with...
Well, because it's the legal aspects of art.
It is legal. That's what makes it interesting. Otherwise, it just lays there like a lox.
Jumps out at you.
It's called, the headline says, screams out in the New York Times in the largest possible type, Rockwell family files suit.
And so, immediately your ears perk up.
My eyes light up. Lawsuit. New Jersey Trinity.
That sounds interesting.
The Rockwell family. Those people are not litigious. But in this case, they were drawn to the courtroom. Why? Because the Rockwell family, perhaps even Norman himself, gifted a painting, if not a few paintings, to a Berkshire museum. And it was for the purpose of the enjoyment of other people who would visit the museum and see the great works of art by Norman Rockwell. Well, that's the way that was for a few years, but at a certain point, things changed. Namely, that the museum...
Well, the museum, it's the Berkshire Museum,
right?
Pittsfield, Mass.
Yeah.
And they say they are struggling mightily financially.
And their solution
is... So this
is
not news. A lot of museums seem to be struggling, right?
Right.
So they have decided to deaccession 40 works of art. They're going to sell them at Sotheby's, November 13th.
And use the money to do other things.
Yeah, to focus on, they're going to reinvent themselves, as many museums are doing, and perhaps focus more on science, right. technology, right. et cetera.
Which is cool as far as it goes.
Yeah, and history, and it's sexy. But
if I give someone a painting and I say, this is so the people in the area can enjoy by going to your museum, the Norman Rockwell painting, it's not my idea that you turn around and sell it and use it for other aspects of the business.
Especially if it might sell for $20 to $30 million. Do
you think that's part of it?
I think that's part of it.
It
always comes back to the money.
Well, maybe it
isn't
does.
It? It's like, oh, we love your art, we love your art. But if we could sell it for a lot. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's, it could be, you know, the Rockwells are interested in the money.
Oh, you mean the one?
It could be that the
I take the high road.
Their feelings are hurt, or they honestly feel these works of art were entrusted to the public
exactly
by giving them to the museum.
Entrusted to the museum to make
just
it available
sees them
to the
as
public.
Furniture, right. You know, that we can sell on eBay.
Exactly. I'm with the Rockwell family,
and other people are involved in the lawsuit. Members of the museum, artists,
yeah.
You know, people who feel this is a moral outrage. Now, you may remember a few years ago, New York was morally outraged because the public library, the New York Public Library, wanted to sell a work of art by Asher B. Durand, Kindred Spirits, mm-hmm. which was a painting from the Hudson River School.
Okay.
And picturing famous New York painter, Hudson River painter Thomas Cole,
right.
and William Cullen Bryant, overlooking the Catskills.
Right.
I mean, so that seems very New York, doesn't it? And was seen to be as part of the New York sort of heritage or whatever. So when they prepared to sell that, there was a lot of outrage. And so the powers that be said, okay, we'll try to give some sort of priority to bids that would keep it within New York.
Yeah.
And so in the end, it sells to Alice Walton, who the Walmart heiress, who's putting together a museum.
But that's different to me. Okay, that's
Why?
Different. That's different to me because people say, don't sell it, I like the painting. I don't know if anybody likes this painting. The point is, they're just saying, we gave you a gift. Okay? We gave you a gift for a specific reason. Okay? We thought you're the type of people who will display this painting for people in the area. And in fact, you valued what we had to give you. Turns out the answer is no and no. Give it back.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. I mean, so I think they have a moral high ground here. Whether that
really,
works in court,
really.
I don't
because,
know.
Because, you know, it's tough for the museums, you know.
Yeah, tough for the museums.
Because there's always that thing. You know, in some situations, you know, I was an intern at the DAR Museum like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, and the DAR Museum has a huge collection of decorative arts,
right.
largely. Okay.
Right.
People giving their old sandwich glass or pieces of the splinter of, Abraham Lincoln's coffin, something like that. And fabulous examples of early American revolutionary furniture, et cetera. And there were a couple of incidents where somebody within the museum wanted to honor one of their members, and they just presented them with an object from the museum, which is not exactly.
I think that's not. Look, I don't know. Maybe that didn't even come to light, but I can see where that would trouble somebody.
Right. So does it, you know, do these things belong to the museum or not?
Oh.
Or do they belong to the public?
Well, the answer is you put it in the contract,
and they're in the charge of the museum, too.
How it comes out legally, I don't know. But I would be ticked off if I were the Rockwell family.
It's a chance for the lawyers.
To make things right.
Right.
Lawyers making life better, as they always do. Well, there was an
making money, as they always do.
For everybody. Making life better for everybody.
Yeah.
It's like GE. Bringing good things to life. There was an article about the brain that was particularly interesting.
It's a review. We love these book reviews.
It's a book review.
That's how we learn everything.
We don't read the books. We don't have to read the books.
We do sometimes read the books.
Sometimes. I'm in the middle of one of them right now. But this one on the brain is interesting. And
the book is called How to Think.
And
it's by Alan Jacobs.
Right.
And it's being reviewed by Barton Swaim, and he starts out the article saying, that's a terrible title, because you can't really give anybody that book. If you give somebody that book and it's How to Think, and then the recipient is insulted.
That they don't know
what
how to
do you
think.
Mean? You, You think they don't know how to think?
They shouldn't be insulted because it turns out none of us know how to think, according to
We don't bother to think.
We don't. That's the problem. We know how to think, but we don't do it. We don't do it. And you know, look, that's a little bit of an overstatement, just trying to make it seem a little sexier than it actually is. But the point that the author makes is a decent point, and that is that too often what people do when they believe they're thinking is they just converse with like-minded people, and they put finer glosses on points that they all agree upon, and they basically reinforce their own somewhat biased or at least settled viewpoints. And that's not thinking. And what thinking is, particularly if you're considering critical evaluation of another viewpoint, is to actually look at that viewpoint as squarely as possible, put it in its best possible expression, give it its due. How, if that person were here today to advance its view, how would he best put his position? And then deal with it squarely and ask yourself whether there isn't something to that position as you think through whether, in fact, the right answer is as simple as you thought it was before. And it is, I think there's something to that point. Yeah. I don't think people go through that exercise. And no. You see that in political discourse and other places also.
We reject arguments with which we may disagree before we even hear them. And social media tempt us to treat people who make those arguments in ways we rightfully find outrageous and abusive when directed at us. Okay, so we're really just, avoiding thinking about things.
Right.
And the way to really think through things is largely by taking the time to try to understand the opposing opinion.
Right.
And actually, this author, this book, recommends one of the things you do before you respond to anything that you're against or negative or want to reject, wait 5 minutes.
Right. Okay. And actually give the other thing its due. Say there must be something to it. People aren't, it's not like the world is divided into smart people and idiots on the other side, worthies and unworthies. There's something to the other point of view, surely, even if it's not 100% right. And the question is, what is it that's driving that point of view? What is it that's correct? And what is it that's perhaps less correct? That's an exercise that takes some discipline to go through, but that's what thinking is.
And he really encourages you to reject, to avoid social media. Because those situations, you're kind of seeking out the people you already agree with.
Right.
And it's just kind of reinforcing your gut feelings. You're not really challenging your ideas or yourself. And as I was saying to you before, interesting that goes back to that book, Getting to Yes.
Yeah.
And then one of the
about
precepts of that, about negotiations. And one of the precepts of that was to, first you have to thoroughly understand and being able to articulate the opposing side and what they are trying to get.
That's the only way to come to an agreement. That's the book by Roger Fry, which was a seminal book about successful negotiation by now some 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 30. Let's call it 30.
At least 30 years ago, I think that you handed me the book and said, try reading this.
I didn't say try. I'd say here's something that a clever young woman like yourself will enjoy thoroughly, and you did.
Right.
There you go. Okay, so we saw something, going back to the theater for a moment. We saw something interesting in the public theater, which we had heard about, and we weren't able to put it together until we saw this.
Yeah, actually, our friends the Walshes were pointing this out.
That's right. The Walshes, who accompany us whenever we go to 54 Below.
Yes.
And during one of our theater discussions, Tom Walsh was telling us that he had heard about this performance at the public.
It's called Tiny Beautiful Things.
Right.
It's based on a book by Cheryl Strayed.
Right.
And
it's not based on a book. It's based on the column that Cheryl Strayed does.
No, it's based on a book.
Is it a book?
Yeah, it's a book.
How does that relate to the column? I thought it relates to the column.
I guess it relays stories from the column and the podcast.
But we ought to explain. The column is an advice column.
It was published as a book.
Okay. So it's so the book is basically codifying an advice column that she writes with this fellow Almond. I'm going to say Steve Almond. And in fact, what they do is they get letters from folks who are often in pretty desperate situations, or at least difficult situations, or seeing real challenges. They have to do with the passing of parents. They have to do with disease. They have to do with being unemployable, no prospects, failed romantic relationships. And they attempt to respond.
In any case, it's an interesting play that Nia Vardalos,
right,
from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, adapted into a play.
Right.
And, it was produced, about a year ago at the Public originally. It's now back at the Public in a bigger stage. Right. And,
but what's interesting is
it's having, tremendous effects on the audience.
The article focuses on one particular performance in which someone in one of the closer rows starts breaking out into huge sobs during one of these stories that's being presented.
At a certain point, a howl of agony.
And they ask the actress, how did you react? Did you hear that? She said, of course I heard it. You couldn't help but hear it. And this is Nia Barrientos. And she said that, in fact, she paused. She was this close to saying, sort of breaking the fourth wall and saying to the woman, take your time, compose yourself, you're in a safe place. We're going to walk through this. But she didn't quite do that. But she
locked eyes with her.
She locked eyes with her.
As if to say, it's okay.
Right.
And I'm with you. I'm going to keep going. But
talk about a theatrical experience where there's some kind of interplay between the audience and their performers, which obviously adds to the experience. And they say that this happens. This is not unique. That it's not unusual that people break out in sobs. And Nia Barrientos says that she generally exits through the main plaza right in front of the Public Theater, and she does
she usually stops to take selfies and sign autographs, but she says sometimes she's so emotionally overwrought
Performance can't do it
that she can't, she waits. And in a review of this, the critic says it's not a successful narrative play in any conventional sense, but it works beautifully as a sustained theatrical exercise in empathy. So that seemed pretty interesting, and it's probably something worth experiencing.
Yeah, and that's the point. They're talking about theater. I mean, that's what theater is. I mean, that's something that's not going to travel in any other medium.
And since we were talking about what kind of interaction we were sensing from the cabaret performance.
Yeah,
This is kind of the same idea on a different level.
Very intense.
It's directed by Thomas Kail.
Right, who directed Hamilton.
Right.
So, well, the Public Theater had Hamilton, and the theater is not a huge theater, which I think lends itself to that kind of interaction.
And they say there's a certain, sort of darkness of the theater kind of seems to allow people to engage more intensely.
Okay.
So that was interesting.
All right. So sort of an offbeat football story. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about something that if it hadn't happened, you'd expect it to happen. It's almost inevitable. There is now a high school football factory, or let's call it a boarding school, which is in California. And it is for the purpose of training high school players to become college football players. And there's no bones about it. It's very expensive. It's $75,000 a year tuition.
And who pays for that?
The parents. They take out a loan.
But generally?
Look, I don't know. The short answer is I don't know.
What kind of people is this for? This is not for people. I mean, you think of the classic football player story.
Well, it's not those
kids
players.
Who have nothing coming from nowhere.
Kids who have nothing aren't going here. There are plenty of kids with
nothing. So these are for
this is for some elite, but they're getting there a different way. These are there from some folks, and they're only going to go
there's
there for
really
a year
a call
or two.
For that?
Yes. The short answer is yes, yes, and yes. So it's called IMG Academy. It's put together, IMG, as you might know, or Hollywood Agents. It's a huge organization. They're thinking of other academies in other fields, quite frankly, because people want to specialize in an earlier age. And what they have done is put together a program in which the day begins at 6 a.m. with breakfast, tape, and treatment. And it goes on from there. It goes to...
And it just doesn't make any sense.
Team weightlifting. Well, hear me out. Team weightlifting, team meeting, special teams meeting, offense and defense, film review, practice, shower, cold tubs, lunch. And then beginning at 1 o'clock, what one might call classes. And they have enough academics. They have, they spend between 1 and 5 in classes and study halls. They do what they have to do to get a
diploma. So how much of the day is spent on how to deal with concussions? And how to recover from brain damage in your old age.
See, this shows that you should read the New York Times too much. I know the New York Times thinks that football is going down the tubes because of concussions and so on, and so much so that there's an article in today's Times about the virtues of flag football. But the fact of the matter is, as far as the rest of the country is concerned, that's not what's happening. Okay, the rest of the country is saying, something, football is here to stay in order for my child to make his mark on the world and to get into the right university and maybe even to play professional, who knows, let's set our sights on this. These people are not having any second thoughts on this based on concussions. Okay, that's what's happening. That's it. I'm not taking a position on the concussion.
Is there any validity to this? Can you spend?
Can you become a better football player?
Can you spend $300,000 on your high school?
First of all, most people just go 1 or 2 years. Okay, mm-hmm. It's not the kind of school you go for 4 years. Secondly, does it enhance your football ability? Does it enhance your attractiveness? Again, yes and yes, no question about it. They have stories. If you have this kind of facility, this kind of training, this kind of specialization and expertise, yeah, they have examples of kids who put on 30 pounds of muscle, kids who increase their or decrease their time in the 40, all the things that colleges look for. And colleges look at this school. They go to the IMG Academy, they visit. They're building hotel just so parents and college scouts can be there and watch these kids, all right? You want to call them gladiators? Call them whatever you want.
Well,
but that's what's going on.
So is somebody really hoping that they start to pay professional athletes? I mean, you know, student athletes?
No, way beyond the story. All I'm telling you is that they have this school. Maybe you're going to view that as another manifestation of the burgeoning football culture. But you can't view it as the opposite. So you have these kids there, and they're out there trying to carve a path for themselves. Their parents think they're doing the right thing.
So where did you find this article? Was this under Signs of the Apocalypse?
No, it's
in
not
the Sports Illustrated?
It's Signs of Better Football. But what happens at the same time, that's in the Wall Street Journal. They're talking about what a great business it is. That's why it's in the journal. At the same time, there was an article about the Columbia football team. The Columbia football team is, believe it or not, successful. For those of us who are somewhat familiar with Columbia football, it has never been successful. You would think it's always been awful. And now they were undefeated going into this weekend, and they could be leading the Ivy League by the end of the year. And it's a huge turnaround.
Do they still have the same old rickety stadium?
They have the same rickety stadium. Well, let me just backtrack half a step. Columbia football has years and years of not winning a game, winning one or two games. It's been kind of an embarrassment. There was one time they tried to make a go of it, all right?
Yeah.
That was in 1985. In 1985, they hired a coach named Jim Garrett, who had a fairly big reputation. He had two sons. One was named John Garrett, who was a running back and receiver. And the other was named Jason Garrett,
yes,
who was the quarterback.
Have we told this story before?
No, we haven't.
Okay.
We should tell it every week,
I tell
week,
it
though.
To all my friends.
You should. Jason Garrett was a quarterback in the NFL and is now the coach of the Dallas Cowboys. He was at Columbia with his father. Columbia was set to succeed. What happened? Jim Garrett went 0-10, and they fired him. They fired him. And he went and he took a job as an assistant coach with Princeton. And guess what happened?
He
took his sons with him. That was it. Jason Garrett could have been a Columbia Lion. It would have been great success. They lost it. But now they're back. And does it mean anything? Well, the article in the Times was a lot of alumni are kind of ambivalent. They say, what are we doing? Do we care about that? Is that something we want to invest in? I don't even know how to think about that. We identify ourselves as losers in Ivy League football. Does it matter?
It's kind of a badge of honor.
To be a loser.
Right, to be, because, you know, the saying, we're you know, intellectuals.
Well,
we're not
going to
excel at
football. One of the people did.
The only reason to go to a Columbia game is that afterwards you can go over to Arthur Avenue and have a great Italian meal.
Exactly right.
Old
and
school
although
red
I should
sauce
explain,
Italian.
You put your finger, inadvertently, of course, on the reason that Columbia will never succeed, and that is that its football stadium is 100 blocks north of a school.
Right.
And that's why it will never, ever succeed on a regular basis. But in any event, they're having a good season. The Columbia alumni, some are taking pride of it. Most of it aren't even paying attention. You know, we have some connections with Columbia. We're not paying attention. But whatever. The point is they don't have any graduates
from
MIT.
We're sort of happy for them.
They don't have any graduates from IMG. Is that what I'm pretty sure is the case? All right. Some other big development in...
Speaking of signs of the apocalypse.
Yes. And that is the demise, not demise, the semi-demise of Lord & Taylor.
Well, they're selling the flagship store, apparently, on Fifth Avenue, 39th Street.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's shocking. And it's not like they're selling it to some other department store entity.
Right.
They're selling it to WeWorks,
which is a big, big organization which is thriving. Right. And what WeWorks
it
does...
It had a $20 billion right. valuation, in for case you've never heard of
right.
it.
Right, when you have it, and you have it.
And it rents out space for...
It develops and rents out space...
For companies.
For individuals,
communal,
too.
Well, individuals, space. But also small right. companies and businesses.
Right. And it sets up the kind of thing you see on television with the high-tech companies, with the open floor space... With the cross fertilization, and you're dealing with other companies and folks
you're playing
on your own,
ping pong,
and there's ping pong, and there's a foosball, and it's fantastic. That's what they're going. That's what's going to be most of the Lord and Taylor space, foosball.
And they're going to keep a little fraction of it.
And they're going to keep the windows. Sort of,
I mean, this is just so. I mean, Lord and Taylor, when it first apparently when this location first opened,
yeah.
There were three restaurants.
Oh, yeah.
There was a manicure parlor. There was some kind of mechanical horse.
Well, yeah, you know, they make the point.
Shopping was the new right. leisure activity.
Exactly right.
You know, that now that people were not just working, they're working 24/7.
Right.
They had enough money and enough, you know, affluence to be doing other stuff like shopping,
right.
spending time in a store.
Right. And that was new.
Yeah.
And that was new. And they celebrated that. Here's a place we can all go and have a leisure life and do some shopping. And it's an experience for us. And now what did people do instead? They sit in front of their computers and they press buy or they press whatever it is.
But, you know, with the rise of the internet, this article says shopping came to look like work.
Right.
And work in many instances has begun to look like leisure. What's and they do cite as, you know, if you saw, you know, somebody shopping on the internet,
yeah.
you know, it might be a middle-aged woman, exhausted looking, staring at a screen
right.
of Amazon reviews.
Right.
In other words, you know, it looks like a harried worker bee.
Right.
You know, shopping is not fun. It's,
right.
It's,
and the WeWorks thing annoying. That's going to occupy it is just the opposite.
And
now we're working
and
we're playing at the same time.
Yeah.
And so it's not just a real estate move. It's a Teutonic shift in cultural modes of life. I mean, it's just, we're flipping the switch in terms of what life is all about. It's
yeah,
not,
it says, WeWork's mission is to help people make a life, not just a living.
Make a life out of work.
Yeah.
You're on all the time, but that's not a problem because you're having a good time being on all the time. That's not what Lord and Taylor was all about. So it's highly symbolic.
It's,
that
it's not a work-life balance. It's a work-life mishmash.
It's all work, but work will be okay.
I'm not sure this works.
I'm not sure either. I'm not sure either. But they will. They are keeping the windows.
You know, I just, wow, I miss those old days of going to the Birdcage restaurant. Lauren Taylor's at a certain point. They had
that.
These little ladies lunching. Oh, you know, when I was in high school
yeah.
and you go to the Bethesda Lord and Taylor with my mom and have little tea sandwiches.
You're giving your age away here with us.
Yeah. Oh, those were the days. No yeah. more of that.
Oof. All right. Yes. All right. I can pass on that, but I get your point. But in any event, the Dodgers, let's get back to baseball. We left baseball long and we are still in the midst of the World Series. And I'm still confident the Dodgers will win for those wondering. But in any event, there was an article, as the Times is apt to do. They wheel out George Vesey every once in a while. I'm really almost too frightened to ask how old George Vesey is. I suspect George Vesey is in his late 80s. And he doesn't write for them as a regular basis, but he was a columnist years ago. And sure enough, with the Dodgers in the World Series, they dialed up George and said, George, you covered many Dodger series in the past, and you wrote about baseball for many years. What are your recollections? And he responded with a column about his growing up following the Dodgers in the 1950s. And what's interesting about that, he wrote, the Dodgers, by the way, were in this series several times in the 1950s, almost each time losing to the Yankees. And he does a little piece about his recollections of each of those series. And what's interesting about that is how vivid his recollection is, even though he didn't see any of the games, well, almost none of the games. In other words, he starts with 1949. He talks about, he heard what was going on. He rushed home. And by the time he gets home, he hears that the game was over. In 1952, same thing. He gets to see a snippet of the game through a store window. He doesn't have a television set at home. He rushes home. The game's over. But he remembers the game precisely anyway. In 1955, he's at soccer practice. And in soccer practice, He's so interested in, I guess it was a soccer game. He's so interested in the game, he goes to the sideline, he sees someone on the radio and asks him about it. The coach takes him out and says, "You are not interested in soccer." And he said the coach was right. So that was fine. His soccer career was over. But again, he was just getting a snippet of the game in the 1 year the Dodgers won. And my favorite is in 1956, this is how he describes it. "I am in a parking lot listening to Game 5. Don Larson of the Yankees is pissing a perfect game. The umpire calls a third strike on the Dodgers' Dale Mitchell. The pitch was outside. I saw it on the radio." And that is basically his situation. He has this radio connection with these games, and it's a terribly strong connection.
All right, so here's the thing.
What?
I went to Mr. Google. Turns out Vessi is 78.
Oh, okay.
He's just a kid.
Just a kid, sorry.
But my question to you is, so are you saying that you feel that people have a more vivid memory of these games from listening to them as opposed to watching them on TV?
I'm not really, well, this establishes that you have kind of a vivid recollection without seeing it, radio and in your mind's eye. And he's created details about what happened while he was on the bus. It's even beyond radio. Am I saying that you can't have that based on TV? I'm not saying that, but I honestly suspect that. Because you don't have
there
to,
may be something there.
You don't have to invest you that to, much to watch it on TV.
Something.
It's too easy.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
that
right.
You're not as engaged. You're not as connected.
Let me give you an example.
Because
of this.
You're just sitting there receiving.
We were talking about the Broadway musicals and just in the car yesterday with the Walses. And how were we introduced to Broadway musicals? And that was by listening to soundtracks. We didn't go to plays growing up. We were, you and I both listened to soundtracks. You talk right. about My Fair Lady. Inevitably, when you listen to those soundtracks, you invent a narrative of what's going on around right. those soundtracks. And that builds a very strong sense in your mind of the play that you never even saw.
So you think it's similar with listening to...
Yeah, I think you invest a lot. As long as you have to invest your own energy in it, it's just going to be a more meaningful memory to you.
Well, that's interesting.
That's the way I feel. But that's...
I must say, it has always amazed me the way you sports fans can recreate entire games
right.
from, you know, decades ago.
Right.
Even games you never saw.
Games that
just
happened before we were born.
World Series games
right.
that you've heard of.
Or even football games. I can tell you right
I
now.
I find that mind-boggling.
Football was on the radio.
Yeah,
it was not on the television. All right, so we closed. There was an interesting piece about Strange Things. Strange Things is a phenomenon. I think, is that fair to
it
say?
It is Stranger Things.
Stranger Things. A phenomenon, right?
It is.
It
we
is.
Didn't realize that. We just thought it was a show we liked. But
right.
it turns out... The whole Western world likes it.
Right. And it is, it's getting tremendous publicity. They're about to go on with season two. Season one was the big success. Many thought you couldn't have a season two.
They released season two.
They released season two. And it's by these two folks, the Duffer brothers. It's Matt Duffer and what is his brother's name? Ross Duffer. The two Duffer brothers. And they have a little interview in the Wall Street Journal with the Duffer brothers. And they are, I will say, interesting, although a little bit kind of what you'd expect.
They're quirky. No, you go ahead.
Well, tell them what
you
I'm not going to go through everything. About
First of all, one of the things that Dan found interesting, and Dan, as a lawyer, is constantly writing, constantly editing,
right,
and working, collaborating with people.
Right.
And we talked about collaboration last week
right.
with Sondheim and Lin-Manuel Miranda, etc. And they have a nice modern way of collaborating.
They do.
Where they use Google Docs, and they're both on the document at the same time.
But you got to set the scene. You have two guys sitting next to each other, literally sitting next to each other, Matt and Ross Duffer.
On their own laptops.
With headphones on. Listening to music, okay?
Not talking.
On their own headphones, not talking to each other, and they're on Google Docs. And what this means apparently is they're both in the same document at the same time.
Right.
So one writes a line of dialogue, and the next one is writing something else. They go back. They delete the line of dialogue they don't like. They delete the other guy's line in real time. So
They're collaborating as if they're talking to each other.
It's a mind hive, as they put it. Although at a certain point, they do admit that if there's too much stating and deleting, one of them takes their headphones off and they actually have a conversation, which you would like to think most people would do anyway. But anyway, I found that bizarre. But if that works, that works. There are a couple of other things interesting. The fact that they never
listen to music.
No, they only listen to movie soundtracks.
And that's how they've learned all about the music they know, it's classical
right.
or pseudo-classical
right.
or pop, is through whatever movie soundtracks.
Right. They know John Williams through E.T. That's to them is classical music. They all kinds of things. They have something about you shouldn't watch Stranger Things on your television, only on the iPad, because they don't think that the settings in the television are sufficiently precise.
The color calibration.
You're not getting the optimum color.
It's always off.
So Tams and I are this close to hiring somebody for $500 to come by and adjust the color on our TV.
Well, maybe you're that close.
No, I'm not that close. I think one of the kids could get the chance.
They say you'd be better off watching Stranger Things on your phone.
On your phone, yeah.
But on your TV, also, if you have the normal, the out-of-the-box settings.
But your favorite piece was about the stuffed animal monkeys. I know that you like that.
Right. Here I'll read from the article. Ross says, "Our production company is called Monkey Massacre because growing up, we made movies about stuffed animal monkeys that come to life and start murdering people." And I just want to say, I can just see that. Just two brothers making these movies with their stuffed animals.
Not that we have two sons.
We made sure in season two that the monkeys made a cameo appearance. We had our parents ship them from North Carolina. We told our prop master she can't lose them or she's dead to us. She did not lose them. They made it to Atlanta, where they're filming, and back to North Carolina, where they are now safely back in storage.
So there you go. These guys are about as strange as you expected them to be. Enjoy season two of Stranger Things on your phones. And
if necessary.
If necessary, or get that color fixed.
And we'll be back next week with more adventures.
And Tams and Dan read the paper.